The Whole Health Cure with Dr. Sharon Berquist, the podcast that brings you inspiration and skills for living a healthy and fulfilled life.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back. Today, we have a really exciting guest with us, Dr. Felipe Lobello. He is an MD and has a PhD in exercise physiology. He's an assistant professor at the School of Public Health at Emory. And his interest is in all things about lifestyle and chronic disease and how to make the lifestyle interventions mainstream in medicine. He currently directs the Global Research and Collaboration Center for Exercise is Medicine, which grew out of the American College of Sports Medicine's initiative. So welcome, Dr. Lobello.
Dr. Berquist, thanks for inviting me to the podcast. I'm very happy to be here.
Excellent. So let's jump right in. You know, everyone hears exercise is good for you, but you know, exercise is so profound in that it affects almost 40 disease conditions. So what is it about exercise that impacts every part of our body in disease states, from diabetes to cancer to Alzheimer's? What is the link between all this from a biologic level?
Yes, I love that question because it really allows us to think outside the box and beyond the, you know, simplified, very profound recommendation for exercise and health. But it to some extent, it simplifies, as you mentioned, the power of exercise in terms of our health. And if you think about it, we as Homo sapiens evolved over the last hundred thousands of years, needing a certain amount of movement, you know, primarily to find food, to escape from predators, to survive in hostile environments. We required 10 kilometers of walking per day, probably. You know, some anthropologists have been looking at this data and say even more, up to 15 kilometers per day of, you know, a mix of walking, jogging, and running at high speed when you're, you know, being chased by
a mammoth or trying to hunt something. Yes.
So that's how we evolved 100,000 years ago. Our genes have not changed from 100,000 years ago until now. What has changed, obviously, is our need to cover 15 kilometers per day. We don't need to spend that amount of energy anymore in our day-to-day lives. But there are some profound, physiological ramifications of not spending that amount of energy, because all of our physiologic systems, our brain-to-gut connection, our muscles and the mitochondria, which are the energy deposits in the muscles, all our cardiovascular physiology really needs that amount of movement and energy expenditure. And if we don't get that, then we have a cascade of negative factors like inflammation, like the factors around cardiovascular disease risk and diabetes and not adequate regulation of sugar in your blood, that eventually lead to the main killers of our time. And we're talking about cardiovascular disease, stroke, diabetes, cancer, Alzheimer's. And that's really the connection between exercise and all these 40 diseases. We really need to get to a certain level of movement, of spending energy. And those that are able to get it will probably, have a 50 to 80% in some cases lower risk of developing these diseases. But those that are not able to reach that threshold, then are going to be suffering, unfortunately, from complications from all of these.
And what's really profound is, you know, when we live in a culture, we take certain things as a given. But when you look at health from kind of a more longitudinal perspective, when you think that, as you said, our genes are conserved, a lot of the genes that are tied to exercise physiology, and our pathways depend on this exercise to be kind of, if you think about it simplistically, to kind of turn on the right genes and turn off the wrong genes. So a lot of the diseases that we're seeing today, you know, diabetes, heart disease, et cetera, or simply not properly expressing the genes that we've had for eons of years. We're just expressing them differently. It's not that these are now epidemics that are new diseases. It's simply how our current lifestyle is affecting the genes that we've always had that are leading to these diseases.
Correct. The analogy that I make sometimes with patients is that if I have certain risk, familial risk of diabetes, for example, it's sort of akin to inheriting a loaded gun. But is the environment around that loaded gun that triggers it? So you can have familial risk or history of diabetes or heart disease or cancer. But for the most part, and studies have shown that you can prevent up to 90% of all these diseases by doing, you know, the recommended public health strategies. You know, have a healthy diet, do 150 minutes of exercise per week, don't smoke. And if you do those things, a very large proportion of health is literally under your control, even if you inherited that loaded gun. So it's this concept of epigenetics and turning on and off genes based on the exposures that we have over a number of years. It's a powerful concept when patients are able to grasp it. Because, again, sometimes it's simplified and people may not fully understand the implications of these sometimes boring public health recommendations. But when you are, you know, able to understand the background behind it and, you know, the very powerful science, both in terms of, you know, basic science, anthropology, sociology, medicine, behind the importance of physical activity and exercise, then it really becomes more obvious, or, you know, it can be an impetus for someone that maybe hasn't been as good about exercising to take on this behavior, because it really affects, you know, everything around your life. All these diseases, in, you know, at the end of the day, have a common cause, which is an excess energy. So you either eat less or you burn more. And probably for most of us, it requires a combination of those factors in order to have what we call a stable homeostasis, or the adequate amount of, you know, energy, especially inside the cells. And if you don't do that, if you have excess energy, then all these cascade of metabolic deficiencies settle in. And over the years, it will shortly lead to diabetes and cancer and heart disease, the main killers of our time.
And you mentioned, I will quote you, boring recommendations. So can you tell us what is the current recommendation, and how was that recommendation, like what went into the decision-making behind that recommendation?
Yes. So these recommendations from, particularly from the government and leading scientific organizations like the American Heart Association and so on, have been going on for about 30 years. So there was this landmark Surgeon General report around exercise and health that was published in the mid-90s. And it's very important because for the first time, the leading doctor and public health professional in the country called attention to the negative effects of inactivity. Just like in the 60s, the Surgeon General did the same with tobacco.
Smoking, yeah.
Correct. So since the mid-1990s, we have a good idea of what's that level of, or minimal threshold of movement, whether you think about minutes of exercise or whether you think about calories spent per week. What is that minimal threshold that's going to help you prevent diseases at a significant rate? And for the most part, those recommendations haven't changed that much. It essentially boils down to around 30 minutes of moderate intensity exercise most days of the week. Most recently has been sort of described as 150 minutes a week of moderate intensity exercise, because there's pretty good compelling data out of studies that have followed people for 30 and 40 years and looked at exercise habits and, you know, what types of diseases they develop, that level of movement is probably going to protect you 20, 30, 40, up to 50%, again, for cancer and diabetes and heart disease. There's like any medication, and this is why exercise is medicine sort of a, as an initiative that has caught some traction, is because like any medicine, there is a dose required for certain benefit. So maybe the dose is a little bit different for preventing heart disease than it is for weight loss. But the minimal level is about 150 minutes or 2.5 hours a week of brisk walking. If you're able to achieve that level, you are getting most of the benefits of exercise. And if you do more, you get a little bit more bang for your buck, but at a lower rate. So, you know, it's better to be a marathon runner in terms of preventing chronic disease, probably, but you also get, you know, some negative effects of, you know, constant pounding on your knees, for example. So, you know, at 150 minutes, you sort of like maximize benefits and minimize risks. And it's sort of like the therapeutic dose of this magic prescription called exercise.
And let's kind of break down that 150 minutes into common questions that I know I certainly get asked a lot. So do they have to be continuous 30 minutes a day? Can it be like 5 minutes here, 10 minutes there? And this other part that I get asked a lot is a lot of my patients wear the Fitbits and trackers, and they get their 10,000 steps, but not necessarily at the moderate to vigorous intensity, which is the current guideline, but they're still getting 10,000 steps. So enough, not enough.
As usually the devil is in the details. So, you know, there's some basic tenets. More activity is better than none. So 10,000 steps is better than 3,000 steps, which is actually the average that the, you know, sedentary American gets on a normal day where you drive 45 minutes to work, then you sit for 8 hours at your office. Maybe you get up a little at lunch to, you know, go to the cafeteria. Then you go come back another 4 hours in the afternoon, get back to your car. Then you get home and collapse and watch 3 hours of TV. Unfortunately, you know, probably 80% of Americans, actually, that's their normal day-to-day behavior.
Oh, that's mine. If I don't make an effort to exercise at the end of the day, I've got about 3,000.
And then this is where you can actually find windows. And they don't require to be a whole 30-minute window of putting on your sneakers and going for a jog and sweating. If you're into that, and most of us enjoy that because it clears your head and it allows you to sort of like, you know, blow off some steam and you feel better after a run, great for you. But you don't require to do that in order to get some benefits. In fact, the data shows that every minute counts. You can certainly break it down in chunks of 5 or 10 minutes. And it's, instead of sending an email, doing a walking meeting or actually walking to your colleague's desk to actually ask a question. Or it means, you know, making sure that you walk your dog when you go home at least for 10 minutes. Certainly the dog will be happier and you will be too. And there's pretty good data showing that dog owners typically are healthier. So it doesn't have to be 30 minutes, like the initial recommendation back in the 90s. Every minute counts. Minutes of intensity at a moderate level, meaning a level that if you are trying to have a conversation with someone else, it will be hard for you because you're sort of like a little bit out of breath. For example, if you're walking, think about walking at a pace, like if you're in the airport and you're about to miss your plane. That's sort of like the level of brisk walking that we're talking about that gets you more benefits. Walking at a slower pace will still get you more benefits than sitting. It's sort of like law of diminishing returns. At some point, you don't get, you know, more benefits if you're just, you know, jogging at 10 kilometers per hour. You know, brisk walking gets you most of the benefits. Walking at a slow pace gets you more benefits than sitting. And sitting is probably, doesn't really get you any benefits.
Works against you.
Correct. So it's finding a way to fit in, you know, a few minutes of movement on your day-to-day. And something that, you know, works for some people is, you know, as much as we are a very individualistic society, is finding, you know, social networks to exercise with. People that, you know, share the same hobbies, the same interests, that are going through, you know, similar barriers to be active, and just, you know, making a case for doing it. And, you know, for some people, exercising alone and going, you know, to swim laps in the pool or running or jogging on your own is great. But not everyone is wired the same. Just as we have genetic differences for, you know, personality and for risk of diabetes and heart disease, we also have genetic differences on the types of exercise that our brain will, you know, get more dopamine out of or more pleasure out of. And for some, the social component is very important. For some, the individual, you know, exercise on your own feels better. So like anything, you need to try these things and see which one adapts better to how you're wired, how your, you know, hectic schedule is. And, you know, at the end of the day, it also requires a little bit of willpower to, you know, to stick with it.
And, you know, it's interesting that you said, you know, you have to kind of see what your brain needs. And you also mentioned for different conditions or disease states, the targets of how much to exercise are different depending on what your goals are. So I'm going to kind of run through a few scenarios. What if a person's goal is to be really productive and focused and creative at work? What would you recommend for exercise?
Yeah, so, you know, the minimal dose of exercise is probably a good start. And, you know, that means maybe finding, you know, 3 times a day where you can go for a 10-minute walk, a power walk, that will, like, really sort of, like, wake up not only your muscles and the mitochondria inside your muscles, but also all those enzymes that help you regulate cholesterol and sugar, but also your brain. And, you know, people report that after, you know, a short bout of exercise, you know, you feel more alert. You're able to learn better. You're able to concentrate. There's very beautiful studies showing that it's sort of like your brain on exercise versus your brain without exercise, especially in kids. And they put kids into functional MRI machines. After, you know, a 10-minute bout of exercise versus sitting on a desk, and you can see these, like, beautiful brain, you know, lighting up different areas of the brain that are associated with, again, you know, attention and learning and concentration. And then when someone's sitting, those areas of the brain don't light up. So there's pretty good evidence showing that, you know, people that are more active and fit in general actually do better in standardized tests. And kids behave better at school. So this concept of, like, you know, having kids sitting and adults also sitting all day to work without those sort of, like, active breaks to rev up your metabolism and your brain activity is really sort of old school. And a lot of interventions right now in the workplace and the school setting are trying to integrate those active breaks so that, you know, you take advantage of that burst of energy that comes with a, you know, a brisk walk or a 10-minute bout of exercise.
You know, and that's something I think we can all learn from. I think the tendency is to use that break to go get a cup of coffee. But I think that that's really good advice, because that's something so many people can do. It's just 10 minutes, and most people need a break at some point. So it's not even really downtime. What if a person's target or their goal is weight loss? I mean, I think that's a really compelling reason for a lot of people to think about exercise. So how does exercise help in weight loss? And I know it's more than just burning calories, because it takes a lot of exercise to burn not a whole lot of calories.
Right. Yes, it's like the Facebook status is complicated. The short answer is that for you to lose weight in the short term, the critical factor is eating less. Eating less calories, because you're right. If you try to do it only with exercise, it takes a very large amount of exercise at a moderate or vigorous intensity to burn enough calories to get you into a negative caloric balance, which is essentially what you need to lose weight. So on the short term, if you're If your goal is to lose, you know, 10 pounds to get into your dress for that wedding, you really need to stop, you know, eating for a few weeks or eat less. If your goal is to keep that weight off and also improve your health on the long term, then you absolutely need to do both exercise and diet. And there's three reasons for it. The first one is that the initial reaction when we exercise is, you know, despite what people think, is actually being hungrier, because your brain senses that, you know, oh gosh, you just lost a lot of calories, and we are here in this earth to make sure that we have enough calories to survive. So most people, if you're not, if you don't know that this is going to happen, most people start exercising and actually eat more and end up having a positive caloric balance at the beginning of the exercise. So if you sort of like try to counteract that and, you know, at least, you know, keep your eating habits normal and try to, you know, burn more calories, that's one way to sort of like go around that. On the long term, by exercising and by making your muscles more active and by increasing the amount of mitochondria against, you know, the parts of the cell that are constantly burning energy, that's going to increase your basal metabolic rate, meaning, you know, you're going to be spending more calories even beyond the exercise session, up to 2 or 3 days after the exercise session. And that means that, you know, overall, you're going to be spending more calories and more energy just because you have muscles that are more active. So that's going to contribute to weight loss. And probably the most important one, and we're still learning a little bit about it in terms of like the science behind it, is that exercise, you know, chronic exercise habits or over longer terms of longer periods of time are going to make the connection between the brain and the gut more seamless. So typically, our brain senses, you know, based on how much we've eaten, based on our physiology, how many calories we need. But sometimes that connection, especially when we are not going through, you know, a healthy habit sort of a period, sort of gets off a little bit. And then we start overeating. We don't necessarily sense adequately how many calories we need to survive. With exercise, that mechanism sort of like goes back to normal, and you start sort of like feeling that you're less hungry, and you start having lower cravings because, you know, your hormones sort of stabilize. So over the long term, by exercising, you are, you know, again, making that connection between your brain and your gut much more adequate. And also there's, you know, data showing that you know, the microbes inside your body also start sort of like being in sync a little bit better. So this is why, in order to keep the weight off, keep that weight off over longer periods of time, you absolutely need to exercise. If you don't, 95% chances you're going to win that weight back, or you're going to get it back, and you actually may end up at a higher weight than you started with, if you only do it through dietary interventions or, you know, eating less.
And I think, you know, some of the points you made are just so important. You know, the first is that after you finish exercise, that for 2 to 3 days, your basal metabolic rate, your metabolism stays higher. So it's not the calories that you're burning during the exercise, you actually burn more calories in the few days subsequent to the exercise that help with weight loss. And I think that's such an important point, you know, when people are just counting calories and looking at how many calories they burn. And the second part, which is really profound, and it goes back to how our bodies are wired, that by exercising, it actually decreases our cravings for eating excessively and eating the wrong foods. So if we're really looking for a way to eat healthier, the diet and exercise really go hand in hand. You can't uncouple the two together. Or if you're struggling to stay on a track of eating healthy, one of the best ways to stay on track is just exercise. And to your point, you really can't just lose weight by diet.
Right. And
not in the long term, at least.
Not in the long term, correct. And the data is very clear about that. So when I see the New York Times, headlines and Time Magazine and others saying that, exercise doesn't help you lose weight. Well, that's a misleading sort of
argument. It's very short-sighted.
Right, argument, very short-sighted because, again, if your goal is very short-term, yes, doing it only through exercise is going to be very difficult. You probably need at least 300 minutes of moderate exercise per week to try to control your weight or achieve weight loss only through exercise without, dietary interventions. But again, 96% of weight loss over a year or two, which is what we all want, and I think everyone in this country is trying to lose at least some weight. If you don't include exercise as part of that equation, there's 96% chance of failure. So, the data is pretty compelling. And I'm going to tell you another thing again, anthropologically. Some people may be wired to enjoy being on a diet, very few. But I can tell you, for the most part, again, we're wired to eat. We're wired to find food and, get our caloric needs, whether they're off because our brain is not sensing it correctly. We're wired to do that. So fighting that is difficult. On the other hand, one of the benefits of exercise for weight loss, and in addition to all the benefits of, regulating your sugar and your cholesterol and like all these wonderful benefits that we don't necessarily think about when our short term is just weight loss, is that, it may be hard to get off the couch, quote unquote, but after that exercise session, you feel good. It's a positive reinforcement because, again, there's dopamine lighting up your brain. And it's a, to some extent, is a behavior that gives you an immediate positive reward from a behavioral point of view. You don't necessarily get that with the dietary component. You may feel good that you're eating a healthy diet, but if it involves cutting calories, it's a little bit hard. We're not going to, discover anything new here. So that's another positive, component of including exercise as part of your approach to weight loss, which is, at least on the short term, the exercise component, once you get off the couch, once you sort of like make that step and like, get to the gym or get, put on your sneakers and you're out, walking, after that, there's a positive reinforcement. There's a good, the runner's high. Some people call it different ways. I think it's important also to maintain those behaviors over the long term.
So how much do you have to exercise to release dopamine?
Everyone's wired differently. So, there are sort of like thresholds for how much exercise one particular individual needs, for example, to improve their cholesterol, or how much someone needs to achieve weight loss or to achieve, reductions in blood pressure. So, to some extent, these are individual numbers or individual thresholds that each of us need to actually test out. The recommendations are sort of like a blanket recommendation for most people, doing 150 minutes a week or, three chunks of 10 minutes most days will get most of those benefits. But, maybe you get the benefit on blood pressure and cholesterol, but you don't really see much weight loss. Or maybe you get, more like some people respond better to exercise for weight loss and for, getting peak brain performance, if you will, but maybe it doesn't do much for your HDL levels. So again, it is a magic pill when you think about all the positive benefits, but you don't get the, exact same response with the exact same dosage in each particular individual. And, that's sort of like a personalized medicine approach now that we're sort of like trying to explore. Can we identify, for which particular patients exercise will get benefits on particular risk factors? And can we also identify, what is the extra dose, quote unquote, that you would need in order to get a particular benefit on another risk factor? So, you know, 150 minutes up until, you know, you get your genes tested and we get, like, you know, fancier ways to personalize the dose.
So that's very helpful. So with the time we have left, I'm going to do a little bit of rapid fire of myth versus fact. So I'll start with some common ones that I get, and we'll keep going. So is jogging bad for my knees?
It depends. before jogging, if you have knee problems, you should actually strengthen your muscles around your knees so that your knee is more stable. But actually, movement for anyone that suffers from arthritis or from, other sort of like joint problems is critical to maintain that knee or maintain that joint working correctly. So maybe you start with something else, and then when you feel stronger and when your knee is in better shape, you can start incorporating lower impact jogging, like, you know, on a treadmill or maybe on grass.
So jogging is good. It's okay if you can do it. Now, how about if a person exercises and exercise causes pain in a joint, for example, in people with arthritis? Hurting themselves or not?
Yeah, pain is never a good sign in with, you know, acutely with exercise. Obviously, after an exercise session, there may be, you know, some soreness, particularly in the muscles, and that's sort of expected. But if you have pain during the exercise session on a particular joint, it's probably because, you know, there is some underlying factor, and exercise is not necessarily making it better. So for most of these situations, you require sort of like, you know, physical therapy to make sure that your knee or your shoulder is, you know, ready for action. And then finding different ways, you know, different movements, different sports, different activities that you can tolerate with less pain. You know, I have knee problems and I play soccer. You know, to some extent, those are inevitable as we age. But there are ways that you can minimize that impact, change your routines a little bit, and adapt so that you can stay active.
So pain during exercise, warning sign to stop. Pain after, you did a good job and keep going.
Yes, to some extent. It should be bearable.
I've always heard the two-hour pain rule, or the rule of pain. So if the pain goes away after 2 hours, that was just the right amount.
Yeah, and, you know, the next day, for example, if you go for, you know, a jog and you're sore, you know, typically the next day people tend to, like, just rest because, you know, I'm in pain, I'm sore. But it actually, if you look at, for example, what professional athletes do after a game, they go for a light jog the day after because it helps clear all the toxins and
all the micro ruptures
in the muscle that happen. So it helps with pain control to do a little bit of movement the day after, and that's something that I recommend.
Oh, that's actually great advice. It's not very intuitive.
Correct.
So that's very good advice. So does a person need to sweat to get a good workout?
No, sweating really is more associated with the environmental conditions. Heart rate or breathing rate is actually a better marker of intensity. So, you know, heart rate, typically we have 220 minus your age is your maximal heart rate. And we typically advise people exercising that if they want to stay on the moderate zone, you should be between 50 and 75% of that maximal for you. Again, 220 minus the age times, say, 70%. That should be sort of your target heart rate. Or simpler, like I said, the walk test. If you're able to maintain a conversation while you're walking, probably that's not enough pace. You need to be a little bit out of breath, not necessarily be able to sing a song or to have a conversation. And that's probably a good marker of moderate intensity exercise.
That's great. Well, I want to thank you for all this great advice and all the tremendous work and research you do in this area. I think you do a tremendous job trying to make exercise kind of more mainstream and put it on the radar in doctors' offices so that we're more diligent about asking about exercise and trying to encourage people. And before we end, what advice would you have for people, you know, for example, people who are trying to get started or having trouble sticking with exercise? Or is there any advice that you'd want to share?
Yes, I'll go back to this idea of finding someone else, and it could be one friend or it can be a group of people. Like, for example, right now we're experimenting with, you know, for adults, even adults with hypertension and diabetes. Let's put them to play soccer, even if they have never played soccer, because just the act of showing up to a field with people that are going through the same issues and obviously adapting the intensity so that we make sure it's safe actually gives us much better retention, and people just get hooked into it. You know, we sort of like forget that, you know, adults can also play sports and can all, exercise can be fun. It doesn't have to be just going to the gym and like pounding the treadmill. Again, if that's what you're into and you get, you know, a kick out of it, great. But for most people, you need some sort of social connectivity around it. So, you know, find others and, you know, just like Nike says, just go do it.
That's great. Well, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
The Whole Health Cure is brought to you by the Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness Center at Emory. For more information about wellness assessments, classes, and other resources, please visit our website. This material is copyrighted by Emory University.